Rusal, which is a major Russian aluminium producer, and they had this big factory in Ukraine. And then it turned out that the owner, at least, of that company was also supplying the Russian army with weapons. At some point, the Ukrainian government said, like, well, to hell with this guy. We're going to nationalize the whole thing. And then Ukraine gets sued over that nationalization in a war context. So it's like, it's mind-baffling how these things work. And I understand how a business owner tries it because the system is there. But from any logical point of view, from the outside observer, especially since it's such a, nobody knows about this system, it's like if you encounter these cases for the first time, they're like, what the hell is going on here?
When corporate giants see themselves losing out on profits because of government policy, they can sue those governments through a special court system called ISDS. From Russian oligarchs suing Ukraine over lost profits in banking, to companies like Shell challenging governments when they're trying to move away from fossil fuels, ISDS can put governments on the grill of large companies around the world. Joining me are journalists Alistair Kepe and Hans Wetzels, who investigated a complex legal system that many might not have heard of, but can severely limit governments when they want to carry out policy that they believe is in the best public interest. Hi, Hans and Alistair. Thank you for joining me.
Morning.
Thank you for having me.
Russia's war in Ukraine has now entered its fifth year. Europe is doing everything it can to stop funding Putin's war chest. At the same time, it wants to support Ukraine financially. But then it turns out, as you guys wrote, there's Russian oligarchs that are suing Ukraine for hundreds of millions of euros. And they do that using European investment treaties. That seems a bit sadly ironic. What is going on there?
Well, you have this very big bank, Sands Bank, and they're responsible for a lot of the financial transaction in Ukraine itself. And they're owned by two guys who allegedly are pretty close to the Kremlin. And at some point, Ukraine decides, look, this is a big national security interest, potentially. You know, what if somehow the Kremlin decides to close down financial transactions in Ukraine, whatever, right? So they nationalize the whole thing to prevent this risk from ever becoming a reality. And what you see is that these oligarchs, they're internationally connected and they use a subsidiary in Luxembourg, ABH Holdings in this case, to then sue Ukraine over that nationalization, which was taken because of national security threats.
Yeah, because it seems like more than a fair choice that in the context of a war, you do not want to have your aggressor still meddling in your country. Like,
right.
Seems fair enough. I think as Europe, that's something you only support, right?
Yeah.
But Russia was not too happy about that decision. And then you're saying that they used Luxembourg to challenge that decision.
Yeah, because after the invasion, Ukraine lifted the free trade agreement between Ukraine and Russia to prevent these kind of actions. But they managed to use, like Hans said, a subsidiary company to use another trade agreement, namely the one between Luxembourg and Ukraine, to file a claim against the country.
And are they successful?
Well, the case is still ongoing, so that is unclear. But experts do fear that if this case turns out in favor of the company, ABH Holdings, that it will open a Pandora's box, because it shows other sanctioned Russian oligarchs that they can use these companies that they have in different European countries to actually sue Ukraine over lost profits.
So that's a worry for the future, but you're also already right that at this moment, Ukraine is already one of the most sued countries in the world. How did that happen?
There are many oligarchs or other entities that sue Ukraine. They because the agreement between Russia and Ukraine itself was suspended, as Alistair pointed out, or is still suspended, of course. They use European investment treaties between any European member states, or the UK, for example, and Ukraine. And what you see happening is that, for example, in the Dutch case, the Netherlands has quite a lot of these investment treaties. Before 2014, before the initial invasion of Crimea, you see no court cases against Ukraine from the Netherlands at all. And afterwards, you see it slowly starts piling up. So,
but if we're talking about a war, about Russia's aggression on Ukraine, then why are court cases coming from the Netherlands?
The Netherlands has a free trade agreement with Ukraine. So Russian oligarchs, if they have a business entity or any company situated in the Netherlands, they can use that company to file a claim against Ukraine.
So we have a Russian company that has a sub company in another country, and this way they can exploit other legal treaties as well.
Right. And the Netherlands is a favorable place for companies to settle. There are a lot of companies active in the country, and often the trade agreements between the Netherlands and other countries are very liberal.
Well, they're in favor of investors in that sense. You have these treaties, and of course you negotiate on every treaty separately. And the Netherlands is a country that prides itself on its investment climate. So it's logical that the treaties the Netherlands or our government signs with any other country, that it will be favorable of investors, which makes it interesting for a Russian to register a subsidiary company in Amsterdam, for example.
This Ukraine example is, of course, super interesting in the context of a war. Ukraine is one of the most sued countries in the world. But the system that you write about in this article is, in fact, way broader than just the Ukraine case. Companies exploit these legal treaties in many different ways. What is this system?
Yeah, so the system or the mechanism actually is called the Investor State Dispute Settlement System, short ISDS. And this mechanism was originally created to protect investors when they wanted to invest in a country that was unstable, maybe due to an unstable political climate, for example, and to kind of protect these investors and promote these international investments. This ISDS mechanism was incorporated in many free trade agreements, basically guaranteeing companies, like if something happens to your investment, for example, if a mine you invested in gets nationalized, or due to something happening within the political climate, you lose access to your company, don't worry. You will get your money back.
What we're talking about is a system that was established in the period of decolonization, when it wasn't logical anymore for European companies to just invest in their colonies, right? So the world had just become a little less stable for European companies, I'd say. But we still wanted to extract resources, or in the best case scenario, help or form former colonies, what we know now as the Global South. So that's where this system emerged back then.
And in its very basis, this system gives a company the ability to sue a country. That's what it really comes down to.
Yes, and it establishes basically how it works, is that you sign a free trade or an investment treaty between two countries, and you basically agree that these are the rules about I'm going to invest in your country, and if the government somehow breaks those rules, we set up a separate court system where I, as a company, can sue the government because that something happened that might have harmed my profits, right? So then you have a couple of courts that are only accessible for these companies, of which the ICSID in Washington, that's the biggest one.
So that means that, for example, we can have a Dutch company that wants to sue the Angolan government, and they do that in Washington.
Yes, exactly.
Exactly, yeah.
And what kind of money streams are we talking about here?
Yeah, so sometimes companies file claims for billions of euros. More often, it's hundreds of millions of euros or tens of millions of euros. But just to give you an idea, for example, of a case that was decided in favor of a company was in 2015, when Italy decided to ban offshore gas exploration within 12 miles of its coastline for environmental reasons. And then Rockhopper, this is a UK-based oil and gas company that was active in the area, decided like hey, okay, this is going to harm our profits. So we're going to file a claim against Italy's decision because they had to dismantle their activities and really scale back and in that sense lose profit. And then ICSID, so the tribunal in Washington, decided that Rockhopper had a fair point, was right, and told the Italian government to award the company 190 million euros. So this is 190 million euros of Italian public money that was paid in compensation for lost future profits.
It's a pretty like almost scary system when you describe it. Like this is really like countries are in a way taken hostage by large corporations. It's not a system that's very well known, I think. How did you first start looking into this topic? How did you know something was going on here?
I actually read some news articles of these fossil fuel companies suing countries for very large amounts of money. So I started looking into it and was really taken aback. And I mean, especially regarding these big fossil fuel giants who are already super profitable, who maybe have to scale back some activities due to environmental reasons. I found it super interesting that they are filing these kind of claims. And I just decided to look into their database and see like, okay, how many claims are coming from these fossil fuel companies, from these oil and mining companies. And then I saw almost by accident that in 2025 alone, there had already been almost as many claims filed by these fossil fuel industries as the year before, 2024, which was already a record-breaking year. So I was like, wow, if the trend continues, then 2025 will be another record-breaking year.
So you saw this topic and you thought, Hans, our free trade agreement man, this could be a good collaboration. We can write a nice article about this together.
Exactly. As it often goes, it was kind of coincidental, right? Because Alistair was just here in the office browsing through this database. I mentioned it and I heard it. It was like, hey, wait, I haven't heard ISDS. This is a term I haven't heard in a decade. So we decided to jump on it.
Was it a hard piece to write?
Not the easiest, because I think this, we're talking about this mechanism, about this system. It's very large. It's maybe quite vague. It's quite technical.
Nobody knows about it.
No, not a lot of people know about it indeed.
But also what's also important is these are all lawyers. So you have to be precise in the way you write it, which makes it even more difficult to write it in a narrative way and tell the story, because you cannot assume things, because these people are specialized in lawsuits, right?
Yeah, and I think that's also what makes it a very interesting topic to talk about. On the one hand, it is this very technical issue, but it does have a huge real-life impact and perhaps even a growing impact in this world. And so there was also really like European and American governments that were behind the creation of this.
Yeah.
And all these decades later, are they still happy with the way it works?
That is a double-edged sword to answer. So yes, I do think for many governments in the West, the benefits outweigh the negative consequences because we do still want to protect our investors that operates in any foreign country, right? So that's still, for a headquarter economy like Europe, that's still important. But what you do see is that there's negative consequences are increasing, in the sense that you have, for example, a big treaty is called the Energy Charter Treaty. A lot of countries around the globe have undersigned this treaty. Obviously, it's about the energy sector. And since we are, for example, in the Netherlands, we're trying to phase out gas. And while the government is trying to do that, you see international energy companies suing the Netherlands, which this is a quite recent development that we, quote unquote, are also getting sued under the same system. I think it was Shell even lodged a claim against the Netherlands over gas extraction and compensation like early 2026. So it's ongoing now. It's not stopping in any way.
So now this system that was meant to protect business interests is actually affecting also European governments. But how does this, if we dive into the court, how does it work?
So how it works is that these courts appoint arbitration lawyers, but it's quite vague who gets appointed and why. But these lawyers get appointed on the case, and then behind closed doors, mostly they evaluate the case and make a decision.
If a case gets filed, the judges are appointed by the parties involved in the case. So in essence, companies can also appoint the judges in that particular arbitration case.
That does not sound like a fair legal system to me.
Well, no, it's. I mean, I guess there's a lot of people that would call it fair because it's all professionals and you need a lot of professional knowledge. But no, I think, and in a sense, it wouldn't be that much of an issue if the whole procedure would be more open. And for me, a lot of it comes down to this. It's ruling behind closed doors, and especially because it directly could harm public interest in countries all over the world, and it involves large amounts of money, that's not acceptable. Power, money, everything converges in this system, and we don't know while it does affect our public policies now.
But does that mean that do countries that get sued within this system, do they stand a fair chance? Or are you essentially saying that the power balance is kind of inherently favoring the companies that are suing those countries?
No, they do stand as it's a court system, right? So it's not that every company that sues wins. That's absolutely not the case. But I would argue that this form of legislative procedures, they are kind of skewed in favor of investors and companies.
Is that also something you saw in your data during this research?
Well, what we saw is that, according to ICSID's own documents, is that companies win about 50% of the times. But that's not to say that. I mean, what a lot of the experts kind of warned us about is the fact that countries cannot file a counterclaim, cannot appeal when ICSID or another arbitration tribunal comes with a decision. So it's like there's no room for countries to kind of win in that sense.
Yes, the best they can do is not lose. But the even bigger problem, I guess, is what experts call regulatory chill. So that basically means that regardless what the outcome of these trials may be, it's massive amounts of money that are put at risk, right? So this basically makes your government think twice about implementing this or that rule, which might be climate legislation, but also other public interests, because the mere threat of all these court cases, because you may get sued and you don't know whether or not you're going to win or lose, right? And it's millions, maybe billions of euros. So if there's an important public interest to protect, you might also consider not implementing that law because you might get sued by Shell or by whoever. I think that's even more of an important ripple effect than the question whether or not you're going to win or lose the case, no?
Or this is maybe also give some examples. For example, in the Netherlands in 2022, the Minister of Economic Affairs and Climate at the time, Stef Blok, he actually warned that further intervention in the coal sector, so closing coal plants, could pose major legal risks in the context of ongoing claims. Also, the Danish government, for example, they had a deadline to phase out fossil fuel exploration by 2050, as opposed to 2030 or 2040, and because if they would have done this earlier than 2050, they might have risked there were risks to pay these incredibly expensive compensation to companies, for example.
But that is, in fact, just really shocking. The fact that countries are maybe not doing certain climate policies out of fear of being sued.
Yes, it is.
Yes, and I mean, of course, it's very difficult to kind of pinpoint climate legislation and governments not doing certain things only on this ISDS mechanism. But you do see in communication of these political leaders that the fear of large claims, the fear of having to pay these massive amounts of money does affect at least their thinking and maybe the the decisions that I made, or at least it plays a significant role. But also, to quote a very famous American economist, Joseph Stiglitz, who actually chaired the World Bank, he also warned that ISDS is actually litigation terrorism, because he said that ISDS cases, the threat of these cases can instill, to quote him, instill fear of environmental regulations, climate regulations, because you know that it's going to be costly.
Look, advocating the devil here, I do understand where the system came from and why it can be important, right? Because not all governments around the world are the good guys. And if you are a company and you want to be protected somehow. But what I find more shocking is that it looks like it's being instrumentalized in a way that it's not about investor protection anymore, but it's being politicized against. In my case, I write a lot about the climate crisis, about the green transition. So it's being instrumentalized by especially fossil and gas and oil companies against climate legislation, but also extending that into what's basically the right of governments to defend the public interest, right? Because that's what our governments are supposed to do.
If governments have this fear and governments are in charge of regulation, then why does the system still exist?
I think that a lot of it has to do with what I already just pointed out, is that the benefits for our own companies and our own economic interests still outweigh many of the dangers. So I think the profits we reap from being active all around the world are multinationals, and we want them well protected. It's much, much bigger than the threat of, you know, being sued over climate legislation, which, as you know, for many governments, it's also not per se priority number one.
So here we have big companies essentially bullying governments.
Yes, you could call it that, yeah.
Yeah, and from what you're telling me, it sounds that like originally the power balance was very clearly, okay, we have the global north as Goliath and we have the global south as the David. Would you say that now that there's, especially in the context of all this climate regulation, would you say that there's a bit of a shift in power balance in terms of how this system works?
Well, in a sense, but what's even more interesting is besides the climate regulation is, yes, the power balance has shifted a lot. And I know a lot of the global South countries and activists in Europe and the US as well have been trying to point out what the issues and the dangers are that come from this system. And it's almost ironic, but also logical, is that our own governments are only starting to listen now that the case has started to hit them. Balance is shifting. And I mean, the climate crisis is, well, in a sense, exacerbating that, because the fossil fuel industry obviously is one of the most powerful sectors in the world, and they're not a big fan of climate laws, right? So there's a lot of pushback from that particular sector. That's logical.
What are the most mind-blowing examples that you came across when doing this research? What court case was really like baffling for you?
Well, I mean, I thought the article we did about Russian oligarchs using the Netherlands to sue Ukraine is kind of weird, right? That was not how, even in the best case scenario, how this system was intended. I think I recall, and I didn't look into that specifically, but you had Rusal, which is a major Russian aluminium producer, and they had this big factory in Ukraine, and then it turned out that the owner, at least, of that company was also supplying the Russian army with weapons. And I don't know if that was aluminium that was, you know, that would be super ironic that they use aluminium produced in Ukraine to weaponize the Russian army to attack Ukraine. But at some point, the Ukrainian government said, like, well, to hell with this guy, we're going to nationalize the whole thing. And then Ukraine gets sued over that nationalization in a war context. So it's like, it's mind-baffling how these things work. And I understand how a business owner tries it, because the system is there, but from any logical point of view, from the outside observer, especially since it's such a nobody knows about this system. It's like if you encounter this, these cases for the first time, they're like, what the hell is going on here?
And for you, Alistair?
Well, we didn't actually write about this case, but I came across it in The Guardian. It's about a case against Greenland. So Greenland actually decided to ban uranium mining in 2021 over environmental concerns and concerns for public health. But at the time, an Australian company had already decided that they wanted to open a mining pit. And they say that the pit was worth $7.5 billion. And they're arguing now, due to the decision of Greenland to not do this type of mining anymore, they're losing this potential profit. So they decided to open an ISDS case. And they're actually suing Greenland for $11.5 billion, which is a massive amount. Just to put it into perspective, Greenland's GDP is a bit north of $3 billion. So suing this company for a massive amount.
So we don't just have Donald Trump going after Greenland's resources. We in fact have companies doing the same thing using this ISDS system.
Yeah.
Now, we have talked quite a bit about I think the way you put it, it was very nice, Hans. It's a double-edged sword for Europe. But so you have also really told us it doesn't really work for Europe anymore. Does that mean they want to change it? Are we talking about potential reforms here, or are we leaving it as it is?
Well, I mean, the European Union has, in its most recent wave of free trade agreements, proposed a new form of ISDS, which in a sense basically comes down to reforming and renaming the system from ISDS to what's now called ICS. That stands for Investment Court System. It's being implemented in the free trade agreements we have with Canada, for example, with Vietnam, if I'm not mistaken. And there's a couple of important changes in the sense that judges get appointed independently. Now states, as far as I can recollect, also get the right to appeal. So there, it becomes more, the doors open up a little. So there's a lot of the criticism that does actually get addressed, but everybody stresses that the fundamental issue does not get addressed. And the fundamental issue being here, at least from how I understand the problem behind the system, is that it's a independent legal channel where investor rights basically rule supreme. And if you reform the system from ISDS into this investment court system, that disbalance, it never gets addressed. It's just opens up the door a little more, but the inequality is still there.
This expert we talked to, she actually described it pretty vividly. You have to see it as like this football game where there's two goals, two teams, but only one team is allowed to score. In which case, that team would be the investor. And she said the reforms that the EU is now proposing, we can check it out a bit more. There's a bit more clarity on how things are being decided, but it doesn't change anything about the fact that only one team is allowed to score.
And going back to where we started this conversation, how's it looking for Ukraine? Do you think that is realistic that they're going to have to pay a bunch of money back to Moscow?
It's still very unclear what's going to happen. These cases usually take years, and these cases have been filed pretty recently. So it's hard to say. I would say these are pretty extraordinary conditions, and I hope a tribunal would take these into account. But really, there's no telling at this point how the case will develop. We keep following this and keep a tab on how it's going to develop and then what's going on. Because, cases are being filed continuously still. Although the EU is trying to move away and countries are trying to move away from it, it's nowhere near dead. It's still very active.
All right. And on that note, we'll leave it for today's episode. Thank you so much for joining me, Hans and Alistair. And we will be taking a couple of weeks break and then we'll be back with a new episode. And I would also like to take a little moment to let you know that from this moment onwards, it will just be me hosting this podcast. I would like to give a big thank you to Alexander Fanta for having been my co-host in this podcast. And we will hopefully see you soon again to talk about the amazing stories that you write. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
You've listened to the podcast of Follow the Money. Our watchdog journalism is funded by our members. Subscribe and support European investigative journalism.